I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have had voucher schools, charter schools, No Child Left Behind, and so many programs in the last few years to try and address the achievement gap between minority students and white students in this country. Our guest this hour has spent a long time doing an investigation of what actually works. And she says the one thing that actually works to cut the achievement gap is integration. Between 1971 and 1988, at the peak of integrated schools, there was a 40% achievement gap at the start, and it dropped, this is so significant, to 17.8% by 1988. If we had remained committed to integrating our schools, she says, we would have kept it going. Not eliminating the gap totally, but it would have been close. Since 1988, when schools started to resegregate, the gap started to widen again. But there are very few people, there are some, and we'll mention them this hour, who are addressing the issue of how segregated our schools are in the country. Nicole Hannah-Jones has spent the last 4 years investigating the way racial segregation in housing and schools is maintained through official action and policy. She has written about school resegregation all over the country and the utter disarray of hundreds of school desegregation plans. She's an award-winning investigative reporter who covers civil rights and racial injustice for the New York Times magazine. She worked as an investigative reporter at ProPublica in New York City, and she has done lots of work on Ferguson, Missouri. She has a piece that has appeared, The Continuing Tragedy of Ferguson, co-published by ProPublica with the New York Times, and it's a collaboration that will explore what segregation looks and feels like in America today. The story in Missouri is a troubling one, and we'll hear about the people involved, and we'll look at Ferguson, Missouri, as well. Our phone number for you to join this conversation is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. We certainly welcome your participation. Nicole, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and thank you so much for this work. It is so important. It is so important. It's amazing to me that we have all this movement for charter schools, for voucher schools, for all of these programs that have cost so much money and really changed education, and yet we haven't looked at this very thing that you've spent so much time and so accurately reported of what seems to work. Our schools are really segregated again.
Yes, they are. Black students in particular are attending schools that are more segregated than at any time since the 1970s. So we are seeing a pretty rapid resegregation, and in many places, including Milwaukee, many places in the Midwest and the Northeast, there's never really been any real desegregation.
Mm-hmm. You talk about what happens when we have integration. What does it do?
Well, what integration does largely is ensure, it's really been the only way that we've seen that ensures that black students and Latino students get access to the same quality of teaching and instruction that happens at other schools. And it also breaks up concentrated poverty that black and Latino students experience, which is where they attend schools where nearly every child is poor. And in the same way that that's very harmful to neighborhoods, that's also very harmful in schools. And so we know that high poverty schools like that makes learning and progress very difficult. But outside of how well students do on a test, so we know that integration, and that means integration that is down to the classroom, so not just getting kids of different races in the same building, but actually in the same classroom learning from the same teachers, it does close the achievement gap on standardized tests. But that's also a very small measure. What it also does largely is for black students who attend integrated schools, they are more likely to go on to college. They're more likely to finish college. They're more likely, less likely to be poor, less likely to go to jail, and then more likely to go on and live in integrated communities and send their own children to integrated schools. So it really does have lifelong impacts on students, both black and white.
You tell the story, and all of these are complicated stories, so let's center on the story of Maria, who was attending school at Normandy in Ferguson, Missouri. You spend a lot of time in the ProPublica article talking about what's happened in Missouri, the historical context, and what's been happening in terms of very segregated and really terrible, terrible schools in that area that are almost, you know, completely minority. Let's concentrate on her for a moment. Tell us about Maria.
Well, Maria is a young lady. She now just started her freshman year of high school. She was a high-achieving student, student who worked very hard, always took the most difficult courses, but she was stuck in a completely segregated, intensely poor school district, and she was being robbed of an equal education. The school was not functioning well. The teachers were not teaching well. Oftentimes, even in the honors classes, they were getting elementary school level work. And so her mom really realized that she was suffering in that district. But because she was a single mother, she didn't have income high enough to move to a wealthier neighborhood or to pay for a private school. She had no choice but to keep her child in a school district that she believed was failing her child. What ultimately happened was the education in that district was so bad that the state stripped it of accreditation. And in Missouri, that's a very rare thing. There are 520 school districts in the state of Missouri, and only two lost their accreditation, and one of them was Normandy. So you have to be really, really bad in Missouri to lose accreditation. And what that did was it triggered a state law in Missouri that says any child in a school district that has lost its accreditation has the right to transfer to any nearby accredited district, and that district can't turn that child away. And so that allowed hundreds and hundreds of students to leave the Normandy schools and go to accredited districts.
Mm-hmm. And the hoopla that took place, the venom actually from the parents, particularly in the school district where she was transferring, which was not really next door, it was 30 miles away, was really unbelievable. Such nastiness.
Yeah, I mean, in the piece that I wrote on this, I called it an accidental integration plan, because in Missouri, as in many urban areas, there's a great deal of residential segregation, which leads to school segregation. And so school districts are largely either almost all black and impoverished or heavily white and wealthier. And what this law did was it forced integration in an area that was not interested in it. And the white parents in the school district that Maria and most of the children chose to attend, Francis Howell, were not interested in those kids coming to their school. They had bought in this community because they liked the way their community looked. They felt that they deserved to have a better education because they were paying for it. And they said some things that, you know, they were concerned. You had mothers talking about they were worried that their elementary school children would be stabbed by black elementary school children coming from the district. They were asking for metal detectors. Someone suggested they should change the start times at school to make it harder for students who were having to get on the buses to come. So, but the only thing I would point out is this meeting, the objections of the white parents to these kids coming in sounded very raw and very bad, but I don't know that it would be different in other communities. I've witnessed similar things in other communities.
Mm-hmm. What was interesting, though, is once Maria started attending school there, she made a friend immediately, and she seemed to fit in quite well. The students responded differently.
Largely, yeah. I mean, I think for the students, largely it's we're getting new classmates. It's not as big of a deal. What parents were responding to was parents felt that they had earned a certain thing, and they were trying to defend that. And so parents had a very different take on it. It wasn't about just some kids who, you know, were making the decision to ride a bus for an hour to 2 hours a day because they wanted a better education. They weren't interested in that. They were interested in guarding something that they believed that they deserved.
Mm-hmm. And just to give us a better idea of the differences between the schools, you talk about this this young student, somebody who fell at, I think it was from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, who fell at a senior at Normandy who was an honor student. The school he went to smelled like mildew, you write. The AP teacher was not certified to teach AP English. At some point, he was given a workshop, which looked to be a worksheet, looked to be at the middle school level, which he finished in 5 minutes and had 40 minutes left. There was no teacher, no substitute teacher for another class. He went to the counselor's office because you had to go somewhere. There was a pre-calculus retired teacher who did care. As far as I can tell, that was the only teacher, and this is an honors student at Normandy who's right. not getting any education at all.
That's right, and keep in mind, this is after the state took over the district. So after the state determined the district was unaccredited, it took the district over and promised to fix these things. And what that kid experienced is after the state has taken it over. And I think what was important about that is many Americans, I don't think, they do not understand how vast the disparities are
yes.
between the kids that the schools that their kids go to and the schools that many poor black and brown students go to. They could not literally fathom what happens in, or doesn't happen in those schools. And this really is the imperative of integration, is that when your child and my child are in the same school together, then our children's fates are intertwined. I can't turn a blind eye to what's happening, because if your child has a bad teacher, my child gets a bad teacher. But when we can separate ourselves from kind of the most vulnerable in our society, we can ignore what's happening in those schools.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing that happened after Normandy was sending students, and 1,000 students signed up to go to this other school that Maria goes to, it turned out they had to pay for the transportation costs. An already poor district had to pay for everybody to be bused there?
Right. Not just the transportation costs. So the way that the Missouri law is built, it's built to be punitive to the districts for failing. And so it's designed to force them to get their acts together. So not only do they have to pay transportation, but they also have to pay tuition. And so every student that went to another district, Normandy was having to pay the cost for them to get there and for them to attend. And oftentimes those districts, because they were wealthier, had a higher tuition than Normandy. So Normandy could be paying $5,000 to $7,000 more to educate a student outside of its district than it was charging to educate students who were in its schools.
Didn't anybody?
What happened?
Yeah.
Go ahead. I was just going to say, very shortly after, Normandy had a lot of problems, but finances weren't one of it. But because of the transfer plan, the district was on the verge of bankruptcy.
Well, did anybody say this is craziness to have this district pay that kind of cost, or did they want it to fail immediately, legislators, et cetera?
Oh, no, I don't think legislators wanted the district to fail, because if it failed, they'd have to figure out what to do with those students. No one expected that a school district that size would actually ever lose its accreditation. So they hadn't planned for what would happen in the case of a district that size losing its accreditation.
Mm-hmm.
And what the legislature immediately tried to do was to actually change the law in order to keep Normandy's kids from being able to leave.
And now it's not really what's it called now? It's a different kind of school district, and it's pretty much back to, it's still all minority and poor, and it's not getting any more funds. But what did the state do to the district now?
Well, when the state took it over, it renamed it the Normandy Collaborative School District as opposed to the Normandy Public School District. And all that was an attempt to say, well, the district is now taken over by the state. It has a new name, so it now is accredited. And by being accredited, the state was saying that those students who were transferring out had to come back home.
I see.
Fortunately, the parents sued, and a judge ruled against the state and said, you can't do that. It's still the same district. It's still unaccredited. And then those kids were allowed to leave again.
Mm-hmm. Well, what happened historically here, Nicole? You write in your article, in 1983, under federal court order, St. Louis and some suburbs embarked on what would become the grandest and most successful inter-district school desegregation program in the land.
Right. So St. Louis, like many communities, had forced segregation of black students and had really resisted integration for decades after Brown. But in the 1980s, a federal judge ruled that not only does St. Louis have to segregate, but that white suburbs, which had led to a lot of segregation in St. Louis, because St. Louis, like many northern cities, lost a lot of its white population. And those white students and their families moved out to suburbs that black people were largely barred from living in. And so this judge ruled that the white suburbs had also led to segregation in St. Louis schools, and they had to help integrate the schools. And so they created a very large inter-district desegregation plan where black students in St. Louis were bused out to white suburbs. And it's one of the few inter-district plans in the country, and it was very successful. Black students did better, and white students did well as well.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, the current governor, Jay Nixon, was at the time attorney general, and he fought very hard to get that plan dismissed by the federal courts, and eventually that plan ended.
Mm-hmm. And not only that plan, but as you cite, hundreds of school districts all over the country have been released from court-ordered integration over the past 15 years.
That's right. And as they've been released, district after district has taken steps that have led to heightened segregation of black students and also Latinos.
Well, whatever happened then to the Supreme Court decision, Brown versus the Board of Education, separate is not equal. Isn't that still the law of the land?
Well, what the Supreme Court has done over a series of rulings beginning in the 1970s with a case out of Michigan was to say that Brown v. Board only dealt with de jure segregation, so segregation by law. And, of course, that left out most of the districts in the Northeast and the Midwest and the western part of the country where segregation was not a matter of law but of policy and practice. So that's made it very, very difficult to desegregate those districts, and the court has largely walked away from any effort to desegregate schools.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you, and here's how you reach our important conversation this hour. The number is 800-486-8655. Our Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and email is talk@WPR.org. Nicole Hannah-Jones is our guest. She is an award-winning investigative reporter who covers civil rights and racial injustice for the New York Times Magazine. The New York Times and ProPublica have been doing for some time now a collaboration to look at what segregation looks and feels like in America today. It is widespread. It's not a pretty picture, to say the least, and we're talking about what the history is here, and the history goes way back. It goes back to Missouri being a slave state, too, and it's an issue that is not only important to Missouri, but as she says in the piece, it has affected school districts all over the country that have become more and more segregated. If history shows us that integrated schools mean that we lessen the achievement gap, why aren't we factoring that in when we look at this important issue of how to close that achievement gap? Integration did just that from the 70s to the late 80s. Why did we forsake that? Why is that something we don't look at now? What about the issue of African Americans having to bear the brunt of integration efforts, too? How does that factor in? We welcome your phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we'll be with you in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're welcoming phone calls now as we look at the segregation of Milwaukee schools, and actually not Milwaukee schools. We're looking at a piece that concentrates on St. Louis. But just to put this in a context for Wisconsin, the vast majority, 71.8% of black students in metropolitan Milwaukee attend hyper-segregated schools where non-white students constitute more than 90% of those who are enrolled. So this is a problem in many parts of the country. Why don't we look at this? Why don't we look at integration and integration being a way to close the achievement gap? All right, let's start our calls with Frank in Onalaska. Hi, Frank.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I've always believed that local schools and public education are the primary focus of equality for everyone. But as long as there's unequalized real estate valuation in the community, you will always have that problem. So when the conservative Republican majority wants to use vouchers for whatever end they see, I suggest that, and maybe you can help me understand why they look at vouchers as a suggestion, but my question or suggestion is to provide a voucher to every minority student, every Milwaukee Public School student, and let them choose to locate to Brookfield and Elm Grove and Waukesha and Brown Deer and Mequon. And I think that the so-called solution that the conservatives propose would then prove their question, because I don't think they want to actually provide a quality, equal education to everyone. And if it's going to occur in their backyard, they'll kill the program and fund public schools the way they should be funded. So I suggest, you know, and why that isn't addressed. I mean, maybe there's a problem with the busing issue or whatever would make that work. But I think we turn that on its head and say, look, if you support devaluing public education by putting money in vouchers, then you have to face the consequences.
Nicole, what do you say?
I think really the answer is strong enforcement of fair housing law, because what is driving school segregation in Milwaukee and many other metro areas is housing segregation. The problem with vouchers is that they just don't provide an answer for the masses. You're never going to have most of the students in a segregated district who are able to get out with vouchers. So I get his point in saying if people were actually having to worry or deal with these students in their own communities, maybe they would think, or politicians, they would think differently about how they fund schools. But really what you need is strong fair housing enforcement.
Mm-hmm. And you also need, there's so many issues involved here too, aren't there? Because you need to deal with the issue of poverty and people having good paying jobs so they can afford to get out of neighborhoods that might not be very good for the schools, et cetera, but it's the only place you can afford to live. It just kind of goes on and on.
Right, but all of that is really rooted in housing. I mean, it is not an accident that Milwaukee
right.
Metro has some of the highest segregation in schools and also the highest segregation in housing. Because what segregation in housing does is it also means that good jobs are located in the suburbs, good transportation is located in the suburbs, home values are lower, and so all of that increases poverty. And what you really want are, you know, there's always going to be people of different incomes, but they shouldn't be living in different communities and going to very different schools.
Mm-hmm. What about this burden? Milwaukee had a magnet school program because it was under order to desegregate schools here, too. So to get white students from the suburbs to come into the city, back in the 80s, they had magnet schools, art schools, et cetera, specialty schools. What happened in the schools that you studied with magnet schools? Was that an answer? And is it still in existence at all to get some white students to also have to do something about integration?
Right. So the problem is magnet schools largely have not worked. One, they usually tend to be on a small scale. They haven't overall drawn large numbers of white students into schools. And what they've also done is even when there has been robust magnet programs, most black students are not in those programs and therefore not getting integration. So they just haven't proven to work on a large scale to integrate schools. And we've seen the federal government has largely defunded magnet schools, so there isn't a lot of money to do it anymore anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And really in Milwaukee and a lot of places, magnets were adopted as instead of wide-scale segregation. So it was choice programs, and decades of research show that choice programs often don't benefit black students.
So if we, and this is a big if, embraced integration as a way to close the achievement gap, what can we do as a society to make it more fair for people like Mario, who shouldn't have to get up, you know, at 5 o'clock in the morning to ride a bus for an hour for a school that's 30 miles away from where she lives? That seems a bit much, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, as we know, the burden of busing was always borne by black students. There were very few places where there was two-way busing. And all students, no matter what income they are, what race they are, would prefer and families will prefer that their children are able to go to schools close to home. Unfortunately, for a lot of black and brown students, that means that they would be forced to go to failing schools. So again, really the answer is integrated housing. We have to have integrated housing because that would mean that the local school would be an integrated school and it would be a good school. And if we're not willing to do that, then busing was the only answer, but it's not a good answer either.
Let's go to Pat in. Thank you very much, Frank, for your call. Pat in Birchwood. Hi, Pat.
Hi.
Hi.
So my question is, in integration attempts, do they move the teachers into the poorer schools so that they can help improve the quality of education?
Did you hear that, Nicole?
No, it was breaking up.
Did they move the teachers as well when we had integrated schools?
Sometimes, I mean, particularly in the South, it was a requirement of desegregation that faculty and staff also be desegregated. But what has typically happened, and this is the problem with segregated schools as well, is that the schools with the most white students would get the most experienced, high-quality teachers. And we haven't been able to break that disparity either.
Pat, thank you very much for your call. Here is a Facebook message from Ryder. Is it segregation or is it money? Do wealthy black communities have an achievement gap? What about that occasional state where all the school districts get the same amount of money?
Yeah, I don't know if there is a state where all school districts get the same amount of money. And the answer is that it is both race and class. What we know is that outside of rural areas, typically in the South, poor white students are not attending high-poverty schools. Poor white students are actually more likely to live in middle-class neighborhoods and attend middle-class schools than middle-class black Americans. So the issue is both an issue of race and class, and that poverty in this country is also racialized. So if you are a middle-income black family, you're more likely to live in a poor neighborhood and send your child to a segregated high-poverty school than a poor white person.
Mm-hmm. Again, looking at the history of this, Nicole, you write in the piece in ProPublica that we have to look at the history, and few places reflect the rise and fall of attempts to integrate U.S. schools than St. Louis and its suburbs. Because of public and private housing discrimination, St. Louis was one of the most racially segregated metropolitan areas in this country, and out of that grows a certain kind of establishment of school districts, right?
That's right. I mean, St. Louis is very interesting, and you see this a lot in urban northern communities where you have these highly fractured systems. In the South, most school districts are countywide. You would have one school district for the entire county, and so if you wanted to avoid integration, you either had to pay for private school or you had to deal with it. As we know in the North, you can just move 5 miles up the road to a white enclave, and that's how you could avoid integration. And so you have these systems where you have tons of tiny little school districts that look very different racially and in terms of economic, and that has made desegregation outside of the South very difficult. And communities fight for this. You know, we really have this pervasive view that the quality of my public schools should be dictated by my income and by how much I think I deserve it, what I've been able to get. And so people feel like if they can buy into a certain exclusive neighborhood or a certain community, that they deserve better public schools.
Right.
And I think that really goes against the notion mm-hmm. of what a public school is, which is that equality of opportunity. It doesn't matter where you come from. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter how poor you are or how wealthy you are, that you will get the same opportunity in schools. And I think we really are going against that notion of public education.
Well, you don't hear very many people talk about it.
That's right. I mean, integration, when we ask, like, why do we not talk about integration, even though we know that it is the most successful tool, it's because politically it's a dead issue. It's a non-issue. It doesn't mm-hmm. matter if you're a conservative or a liberal. This is a political issue that no one wants to deal with.
You cite several public figures in your article, a member of the State Board of Education, I believe in Missouri, said, and this is an interesting comment, if we treated the civil rights movement the way that we've treated the education of black children, we'd still be drinking out of colored drinking fountains.
I mean, absolutely. When you look at the great civil rights legislation that was passed in the 1960s and the successes of the civil rights movement, the 1964 Civil Rights Act dealing with public accommodations has been highly successful. You know, you wouldn't walk in. It would be extremely rare to walk into a restaurant and be told someone that you can't be served because of your race. The Voting Rights Act has been extremely successful, but the two civil rights areas that we've had the least success have been housing, which is considered, the Fair Housing Act is considered the one failure of the great civil rights legislation, and schools. Those are the areas where we've made the least progress. And we really only had a very short one-generation period of intense efforts to integrate schools, and then we very quickly walked away.
Mm-hmm. What, there are some, and you cite these in your article, there are some court challenges going on, aren't there, in Missouri?
Yeah, well, the court challenges are specifically dealing with the Normandy District and the state's attempt to say that those kids no longer have the right to transfer. And a judge has actually ruled against the state on that. So the judge said that those kids did have the right to transfer. So now the efforts are focused on changing the law, which would then make it difficult for those kids to transfer. And what's, I guess, most interesting about that is, you know, the Normandy School District had been under probation for almost two decades, and you could not get any political will to talk about it or do anything about it. But as soon as those kids got a get-out-of-jail-free card and were able to leave that district and go into more affluent white districts that didn't want them, suddenly the governor, legislators, everyone was talking about how to fix this problem, but not fix the problem of the Normandy schools to make them better, but to fix the problem of a law that allowed those kids to leave.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is a great insight on kind of where we are on this issue.
Right. Pat, thanks for your call. Julia in Appleton. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Julia.
Hey, I was asking a question towards the idea of integrated housing as a solution to this issue of segregation in schools. My brother has lived in Harambee, which is a neighborhood just next to River West in Milwaukee, for many years, and it's extremely segregated there. And there's a lot of violence. And I'm just interested in how you can solve that issue of integration when it feels almost as though the community is not ready for it. I see a lot of low-income white people moving into Harambee, and then there's a lot of violence towards them as though they're encroaching on that neighborhood. And it's sad, and I don't quite understand how to solve that problem.
I mean, I don't know the exact situation that you're talking about, so it's actually hard for me to answer your question.
Well, she's saying that her brother's living in a primarily black area that's on the north side of Milwaukee, and as a poor white people who are moving into that area, they're experiencing violence from the members of that community, from the Harambee community, which is African American.
Okay.
I think that's what she's
right.
saying.
Again, without, I mean, I can say that violence is often what we hear as a reason why integration into schools and communities are difficult, but to the extent that violence is being overestimated is a pretty common phenomenon. So without me actually knowing that community and what's happening on the ground, it's hard for me to speak to that, except that racial perceptions are very strong.
Mm-hmm.
And often even one or two events can suddenly be used to paint broadly a community. And it's impossible for me to speak on that without knowing if there's been extensive violence or if there's been maybe an incident or two that have now kind of being blown out of proportion. I have no idea. So I can't answer that question.
Well, in the school district that was looking at the students coming from Normandy, before any of the students even arrived, what the parents were saying was just, You know, do we got to have metal detectors? Do we have metal detectors? I'm worried about the safety of my children. And as you say, there were no incidents when these students arrived. But all these perceptions of who these 1,000 students were, well, they're, you know, they're all going to hurt us. We better be careful. We're scared of them.
That's right, and we have to put this in context. I mean, these same arguments are the same arguments that were used in 1964 and 1954 and 1944. The fear of that black students are violent, that they don't value education, that their families don't value education, are very rampant, and that's really what you have dealt with. That's why efforts to integrate have been very difficult, because there is a lot of fear, there are a lot of stereotypes, and it's not to say that there is never violence in these communities. Of course there is, but there's also violence in white communities. And integration is not going to be easy. I think we kind of all wanted this to be something, an easy fix, but we have 400 years of history, and that is not easily overcome. But then the answer has been to give up instead of to continue to try.
I know that it's hard for people to believe that there was busing in Iowa, that people think there isn't not much of an African-American population in Iowa.
And they would be right. They would be right.
But you were bused, weren't you, to the other side of town? Tell us your story.
Yeah, so the state of Iowa, like the state of Wisconsin, is very heavily white, but also like the state of Wisconsin, we have a few cities with a pretty substantial black population. And I grew up in a city called Waterloo. It was about 15% black, which is the highest rate in the state. And Waterloo entered into a voluntary desegregation program in the 70s, and they did what was called open enrollment, which your listeners might be familiar with. And that basically allowed black families to opt in to a busing program, but no one was forced. And so my parents, starting in the second grade, they entered me into the busing program, and I would ride the bus for 2 hours a day to almost entirely white schools. It was 1 hour one way, but 2 hours total. And so, yes, I was part of a desegregation program, though at the time I didn't know that's what it was.
Were you afraid?
No. I mean, I was in second grade, and all I knew at that time was I always rode the bus to school, and I just knew that suddenly my bus ride got a lot longer. But at that age, it didn't mean anything to me.
We're going to welcome more phone calls in a moment. Nicole Hannah-Jones is our guest this hour. She has spent many years now exploring race in America, and she has a new piece, and it's a very important piece. It centers on Ferguson, Missouri, and she writes about Michael Brown and Michael Brown's mother and her experience with integration and her hopes for Michael Brown and the school system in Normandy, school system which is really awful and lost its accreditation. And it looks at the history of Missouri. She's been concentrating on lots of issues concerning race and centering on school segregation. The Continuing Tragedy of Ferguson is her latest piece, co-published by ProPublica with the New York Times, and I believe it's on our Facebook page. Is it on our Facebook page? It's really worth a read. It's a very important story. It's a collaborative project that is an exploration of what segregation looks and feels like in America today. Here's our phone number. Join us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go back to phone calls for Nicole Hannah-Jones. Gary in Merrill, hi.
Yes, hi. So you have a white couple with one or two kids. They both work hard. They're able to save enough money to move to a nice area, maybe buy a house. On the other hand, you might have a mother with who's never been married, five or six kids. You can't expect those two families to be equal. There's no reason why that white couple should have to pay for that black woman to move in next to them. And I think these are always such racist commentaries on your show. I think it's time we start expecting more responsibility from the black community.
Nicole, take it.
So, the first thing I would say is what a child's parent does or doesn't do has nothing to do with whether that child deserves an opportunity to live in good housing and to attend good schools. So that's the first thing I would say. The second thing is, of course, like that whole analogy is completely racialized and loaded. The assumption that a woman who doesn't have a husband for whatever reason or has more than one child is also not hardworking just because she happens to be poor, I think is very biased. And what we're also talking about, again, is that it would be one thing if every poor person were living in inner-city poverty, but that's simply not true. What the data shows is that the white poor are living next to you, and they are sending their kids to school with you because they have access to middle-class white communities. It is the black poor who are living in concentrated poverty and do not have access to that, and also many middle-class black families who are just like yourself, two-parent homes, hardworking, as you say, educated, are also having a very hard time buying into more prosperous communities. So it's not just an issue of who deserves. And I would say every child, regardless of what his or her parents do, deserve to have a quality, equal education and to live in a safe neighborhood.
Yeah, just despite all the comments that Gary made, which are questionable, this whole idea of providing everybody, isn't this part of what America is, that you provide an education that's a quality education to everybody in this country, no matter what your situation is, so that you have a chance to go to college if you want to, or to become more educated, to make sure that you get a calculus class if that's what you want, and not have your school not even offer it? Aren't we supposed to give that to everybody in America?
I mean, that is the quote-unquote American dream. And if you look at the history of public education in this country, that is why our country grew to be so prosperous, was that while many European countries were withholding education only for those who could pay for it, we decided very early on in this country that your stature in life, whatever your parents have been able to do, would not determine your access to education.
Right.
That is what our country was built on, and that is what allowed our country to have a large middle class, was that it didn't matter if you grew up poor, it didn't matter if your mom was a drug addict, you could go and get a quality education in public schools. So I think this notion, again, that because I think I worked hard, that my child deserves something.
Right.
Public schools that other kids don't is very problematic, and it's really not good for our country as a whole, because I believe that these are all American children that we're talking about, and none of them should be less deserving of a strong public education than any others. These are all of our children.
Let's go to Julia in Stockholm. Hi.
Hi. Thank you so much. This has been a great show. I really appreciate the comments that your guests have been making. Is there any movement in the U.S. to remove the connection between property taxes and education so that there's some way of having schools be at least more fairly funded? I know that won't change the segregation problem, but maybe some of the funding problems could be changed if there was some sort of equal, I don't know if that makes sense.
They've done that, haven't they, Nicole, in some states?
Well, I mean, the thing is, it's a great question. I think resources are obviously a huge issue with these segregated schools, but the Supreme Court has actually ruled that students do not have a right to an equally funded education, that that's not guaranteed by the Constitution. And so unequal funding is actually completely allowable, and while some school districts have attempted, or some states have attempted to address it, because so much of school funding comes from local property taxes, it just leads to a wild variance. And even in some states where there have been lawsuits, and for instance, North Carolina, where a federal judge said that under the state constitution, it was illegal to fund the way that schools were being funded, there just hasn't been a will to do anything about it. So I think that's a huge issue, but there's very little legal space to do anything. It would have to just be the will of politicians to do something about it.
Steve in Madison, hi.
Yes, I really enjoy your program. I strongly disagree that a lot of the Wisconsin schools now, a lot of Wisconsin taxpayer money seems to be going to private schools, which I totally oppose. And so that means that a lot of this money that would normally go to public schools is getting to private schools. And I just think that's so unfair that people, you know, the parents, if they want to send their kids to a parochial school or a private school, then they should pay for that. And that's not the way it's going. The way it's been going lately is a lot of this money goes to, directly to the private schools. And I'd like to know what your guest thinks about that.
Thanks, Steve.
Well, I think when you look at the history and the notion of public education, anything that is taking funding away from the masses of children, because, again, voucher programs, other kind of tuition grant programs, they're never working for the masses. They're allowing an escape hatch for few children. And I really think public educational policy has to be geared around how do you help most children or all children get a quality education. So I think a lot of people are concerned about the amount of public dollars that are going to fund private education.
Do you know, as we're having, as you know, this huge educational change in the state of Wisconsin and other states are as well, do you know of any states, Nicole, who are looking at the very issue that seems to have closed the achievement gap for some years? Is there anybody who's saying, hey, this is what we got to do. We got to integrate the schools somehow. We got to deal with our housing segregation. This is what works.
I think that it's a pretty national failure on both fronts. There are no states that are doing anything. There are individual school districts that are still working on these issues of integration that have not been willing to walk away from this, but they're becoming increasingly rare. And in terms of fair housing and housing integration, I did a year-long investigation showing that really from the federal government on down, there's almost no will to enforce fair housing laws. So we're seeing very, very little movement on this area. But what I can say is it's been a very long time since communities were even discussing segregation, and those conversations are happening now, and that's where change starts. So I think that our listeners can take some hope in the fact that communities are starting to discuss this. It is no longer an issue for which one cannot mention its name.
Mm-hmm. And here's a Facebook message from Beth, who says, this is a very touchy subject for me. I was a white St. Louis student in 1980 when desegregation started. I resented that I had to be bused to the school an hour across town, opposed to walking to the high school right in my neighborhood. She says the African-American teachers favored the African-American students. It was so new, and their bias was so evident. She says she dropped out of high school in her senior year because of this. How did that help anything? And most of my white middle-class friends chose to drop out and get their GEDs.
I'm sorry that happened to her. And again, I think we wanted this to have been easy, but we have to understand what desegregation was doing was trying to break down 400 years of legal segregation and apartheid. And what Brown v. Board of Education was about was saying that black students had been denied their constitutional rights, and we had to correct that. To think that there would be no inconvenience or difficulty in that, I think, is naive. And it doesn't make her experience any less difficult. Believe me, I was bused. It was very challenging for me. But it also was the only way that I could get access to a quality education. So, of course, this was going to be hard. I think had we not given up, it would have become a lot easier. But I have no doubt that for many students, both black and white, who, of course, had nothing to do with our country's long history of racial discrimination, these were very difficult years.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's an issue that remains so incredibly hard. And you think you're making progress for a while, Nicole, and then look what happens. It it must be really difficult for you to be writing about this year after year and not see a lot of change.
It can be, it is challenging work, but I guess the alternative is to ignore it and also ignore the plight of so many children who are trapped in unequal school, so
right.
We have to keep doing the work.
Yeah, well, and good work it is. Thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Thank you for dedicating a whole hour to the issue.
Yeah, our pleasure. Nicole Hannah-Jones, our guest, an award-winning investigative reporter. She covers civil rights, racial injustice for the New York Times Magazine. She has a long piece published by ProPublica with the New York Times, which is on our Facebook page, and I urge you to read it. It's very, very thorough and looks at the history of the problem and what seems to have been working to close the achievement gap and why we're ignoring it now. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this hour, and to Scott as well for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios, where we have our own set in Milwaukee of issues with segregation. So it's important for us to read the article as well. Thanks for listening, and please continue to listen.